Okay, great. Hi, everyone. This is Jody Jacobson of RH Reality Check. I wanted to welcome all of you to this call today, focusing on the milestone of reaching a world population of 7 billion people. We're really appreciative of you taking the time to join the call, and we have some great speakers, and I'm not going to take too much time before introducing them. I did want to remind everyone to please mute your phone by using star 6, because we want to keep the call as focused as possible. And we will have time for you to ask questions afterward. So in reaching this global milestone, we are seeing a lot of progress in terms of increasing efforts to meet the unmet needs for family planning and increasing awareness of general demographic trends and their effects on the environment, consumption, population growth, et cetera. But we also face a lot of challenges, especially with regard to the same issues, responding to environmental degradation, preventing environmental degradation, meeting the unmet needs of the more than 200 million women worldwide who still don't have effective access to family planning and want it. There are a lot of things that we need to attend to, and we have on the phone some experts who are very focused on these issues, both at the global level and within country. We're going to introduce briefly first Susan Cohen, who's the Director of Government Affairs at the Guttmacher Institute in Washington, D.C., and who has worked on these issues for many years. Second, Roger Mark D'Souza, who is a Vice President at Population Action International, and who will speak about environmental issues and population trends. And third, Ishita Chowdhury, who is the Chief Executive Officer of the YP Foundation in India, and who works on issues regarding the health and rights of youth and young adults and adolescents. I also want to point you to a series, and we'll send out the link afterward to this series again, of articles on these very issues that we've been publishing and disseminating for a few weeks now that have a really great set of analyses from various perspectives, including pieces authored by the folks on the phone. So we'll send that link out, and after this call, we will make an audio recording available. So with all of that, I'm going to ask each of these speakers to speak for no more than 5 minutes, and we're going to start off with Susan Cohen, and then we will turn to questions. Again, thank you for joining us, and keep your phone on mute.
Thank you very much, Jody, and thank you for being on the call. As Jody mentioned, this new population milestone that we have reached or are about to reach is prompting renewed important debates about the balance between population size and consumption of natural resources, about the balance or the issues that have come up in looking at age structure and political stability in poor countries, and the consequences of rapid population growth for poor countries' ability to develop economically. But these macro-level dilemmas really are a reflection of a micro-level problem. And unlike these really big, complicated issues, on this one, there's actually a universal consensus. And the solutions, while not simple, are relatively straightforward. We know that there are 800 million women in the developing world who want to avoid having another child within the next 2 years, but a quarter of them are not using a modern method of birth control. There are lots of reasons for this. Some of it has to do with the side effects of the existing methods that they have available. Some of the side effects are real. Some of them are perceived, a result of lack of accurate information and counseling about the methods that are available to them. In many cases, women don't really have a full range of choices, which limits the appropriateness and effectiveness of the methods that they do end up using. There are cultural barriers to using birth control. There are cost barriers, and of course, there are problems with geographic access. These 215 million women with an unmet need for modern birth control account for 80% of the 75 million unintended pregnancies that occur worldwide each year. And that results in many unwanted births and many, many unsafe abortions that take women's lives and impair their health. Most of us women want children at some point in our lives, but we also want to control when we have them and how many we have. But in most poor countries, this basic human desire in the direction of having smaller families still outpaces the availability and use of modern contraception. If we take action now to respond and meet the existing need that I talked about, there are organizations like the Futures Group and others that have done very exquisite mathematical modeling that shows that fertility rates could actually level off by the middle of the century just by meeting the existing unmet need. It is a win-win for all of us. This path forward, therefore, has to include a central focus on increasing access and eliminating barriers to voluntary contraceptive services. These are services women want and need, and they lead to fewer unintended pregnancies, fewer unsafe abortions, which means improved maternal and newborn health and a better chance for women and their families to lead healthier, more productive lives. The United States has been a leader in providing financial support and program and policy leadership globally in this field for decades. The Obama administration sees family planning and reproductive health as central to its global health initiative and, as such, considers it a priority program area. They also recognize it as an essential component to being able to make a dent in lowering maternal mortality and improving maternal health worldwide. It is one of our smartest and most popular and most cost-effective investments. It is controversial only within certain factions of the United States Congress who have targeted for disproportionate cuts, and they want to slap on restrictive policy measures that go back to the bad old days. So far, they have been rebuffed by the evidence and by the reality that these programs work. If we are successful in protecting and hopefully bolstering the United States effort, we will be able to continue working with other donor nations and developing countries themselves by responding to what women tell us they need and want, to address the needs of people and the larger challenges facing our planet at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was terrific. And again, I want to remind everybody that there's an excellent piece on the site on RH Reality Check, which we'll send out later by Susan on these issues, and also an audio recording coming up. Next, we'll have Roger Mark, please.
Thanks very much, Jody. Thanks all for joining the call, and thank you, Susan, for those excellent framing comments. I wanted to build on one point that Susan made, a very important point about just recognizing that this is a macro problem, but ultimately we look at it from a micro perspective. And I want to do so by sharing with you the perspective of a woman who is based in Ethiopia, Aregash Ayele, who has told us a little bit about how she sees these issues. And she said to us in talking to Population Action International that a woman's burden is great. She works and carries a heavy load. A woman's life is hard, and climate change is making it harder. This is one of the compelling stories that we have documented in our recent film, Weathering Change, that takes us to Ethiopia, Nepal, and Peru to hear stories of women as they struggle to care for their families while ensuring that they can meet the needs of themselves and their families while enduring crop changes, failures, and water scarcity issues. So a very important critical point for us to understand and appreciate is that women are especially affected by climate change. In addition to caring for families, they're usually responsible for collecting fuel, water, and food, and climate change can make those tasks even more difficult. So the first point to understand and appreciate is the critical role of women, and this landmark of $7 billion reminds us that we must focus on women and what they want, ultimately. The second point that I'd like to elaborate on is to think about what this means in terms of a broader application. We at Population Action International have conducted an analysis looking at critical trends related to population growth, projected decline in agriculture production due to climate change, and low resilience to the negative impact of climate change. This analysis which we consider an analysis of population and climate change hotspots, provides some very compelling data. We have found that 26 countries are recognized as population and climate change hotspots. And in these hotspots, the average population growth rate is about 2.2%. And if unchanged, that could result in a doubling of the population in 31 years. So a very critical perspective for us to recognize as we look at the 7 billion landmark, broader impacts, these issues all coming together. So we recognize women are critical, that there's sort of a broader impact. And when I talk to Americans and colleagues internationally and policymakers, they say, well, what can I do? What does this mean for me? And one of the ways that we have been working to make folks understand how this issue relates to them directly is to have them think about this 7 billion landmark and how they fit in. And we have created an app. It's called What's Your Number? What's-your-number.org. And it allows you to put in your birth date and your number comes up. You have a sense of, based on when you were born, what your number is, and there's 7 billion people, and it gives you a really good perspective on how you relate to this global phenomenon. On another level, we recognize, as Susan has noted, that we have to continue to think about supporting contraception and family planning. Evidence demonstrates that it is an effective intervention. It is what women want. It helps improve the health of women and children. And domestically, the polls have shown that 75 to 90% of Americans support international family planning programs, including 69% of independents and Republicans. So here we have a win solution. The win solution is, we know that women are critical, that they're broad impacts, and we know what the numbers are and how we can take action, and that action leads us to concrete results based on what women want.
Mark, really appreciate it. And now we will turn to Ishika Chaudhary from YP Foundation in India.
Thank you so much, Jody, as well as Susan and Michael, for that critical analysis. I'm going to apologize in advance for any loud explosion sounds behind me. Today is a festival day in India, and I can't seem to find a soundproof room where I'm working currently. Just to take the conversation forward, in the country that I largely come from, India, population is not necessarily a positive word. So our economy boasts of an economic growth that is at a strong 8.5%. Yet when you look at whether over the years an increase in population has, say, increased the quality of people's health and their lives, the statistics look very different. Just to contextualize, I come from the context of working with young people in a youth-led and run organization, the YP Foundation, and we've worked with about 300,000 young people in India over the past 9 years, largely supporting them at urban and rural levels to create programs and influence policies in the areas of gender, sexuality, health, education, the arts, and governance. Now, reaching the 7 billion mark, I think whilst it is a reminder of the incredible resources we have as human beings collectively, it is also an opportunity for policymakers, government heads, and countries to really reinvent our strategies on how we use these resources to reduce inequality based on the premise that is largely globally accepted, which is that we are currently leading unsustainable lives. Now, as it stands today, one person in five is between the ages of 15 and 24 years, which means that one-third of the world's population constitutes young people. Most young people, about 85%, live in developing countries, with about 60% of that population in Asia. Two-thirds, therefore, of the world's young people are growing up in countries that have an extremely low per capita income, where the annual income is below $1,000. So historically, if adolescence and young people and youth has been considered the healthiest period of a person's life due to low mortality rates, research consequently has shown that today we're looking at over one-third of an estimated 333 million new cases of sexually transmitted diseases each year that are actually occurring in young people under 25. Additionally, one-third of all births each year are amongst young women, many of which are unplanned or unwanted. And if you look at developing countries, maternal mortality in young women under 18 are 2 to 5 times higher than in women aged 18 to 25 years. And if you go even younger and look at adolescents are currently undergoing between 1 and 4.4 million abortions each year, most of which are unsafe. Now, a lot of this comes down to, in our work, seeing very, very limited political will to ensure the health and rights of young people and women, particularly the sexual and reproductive health of young girls. And this means that young people, as a result, are at high risk to violence, to HIV, unwanted pregnancies, unsafe abortions, and have poor and limited access to healthcare. In light of this, investing in putting women and girls at power with men and boys and ensuring that young people have access to comprehensive sexuality education and youth-friendly health services is largely critical. The four major UN agencies, the World Health Organization, UNICEF, UNFP, and UNAIDS, have largely reached consensus today that 5 major interventions are needed in policy and programs to promote youth health. One is to create a support and a safe environment. The second is to provide scientific evidence-based access to sexuality education and information and look at largely removing policy barriers at country level that will restrict access. The third is to build skills, largely ensuring that stronger life skills are present in young people and ensuring that there are stronger livelihood opportunities for young people. And the last is around providing access to youth-friendly health services. This is both in terms of expanding access to services, which includes things such as the unmet need for contraception, as well as increasing the number and quality of health service providers. So to sort of bring it down to where we are in this particular moment, I would say it's also a call for action where we need to try and empower young people instead of trying to save and protect them so that they are largely best placed to negotiate challenges that they face themselves. The logic behind this is that if you commit to ensuring that young people have a high standard of sexual and reproductive health, they are, as an end result, able to tackle multiple challenges collectively. And these include eliminating gender inequality, gender-based violence, reducing HIV and STIs, as well as improving the quality and standard of living. This will automatically increase economic growth, and it also promotes the development of a country's most precious resource, which is largely its human capital, which are mostly young people. The last two would be around, I think, the need to generate qualitative and particularly disaggregated data that maps the behavior of young adolescents. This work goes a long way towards providing successful strategies to governments and policymakers on how best to reach diverse and at-risk groups of young people. And lastly, to invest in empowering young people at actual community and grassroots levels, so that they can be actively involved in the monitoring and evaluation of healthcare services, and they can work with the government. I think that unless we really look at investing in working with young people and not just for them, and look at long-term outcomes in improving young people's health, you won't see increased outcomes in either employability, economic growth, and equality in communities. Most UN agencies have actually found from experience that the active involvement of young people is one of the most important principles of successful programming. And I think the challenge at $7 billion is going to be for those who design policy and fund programs is how do you improve the quality of young people's participation and skills rather than simply targeting specific diseases or interventions. So I'm sort of going to rest on that point, really highlighting that policy, I think, has to be directed at improving the daily realities of young people's lives for it to be effective and meaningful.
industry experts on the phone when they can give you so much information in a really concise period of time. It's fantastic. Thanks to all three of you. I want to now open for questions and remind everyone that there will, in fact, be an audio file available of this call afterward. But I want to open up now for questions. I'm going to let Brady handle the questions.
All right. Thanks, everybody. All of our listeners are now, their lines are muted. So if you'd like to ask a question, just hit *7 to unmute your line and ask a question. We'll just take them in the order that they're received. Again, *7 to unmute your lines if you'd like to ask a question.
Susan could say a little bit more about the current prospect in terms of U.S. policy and funding streams for voluntary family planning programs. What do we really need, and where are we in terms of actually getting it?
Jody, who are you addressing that to?
To Susan.
Okay.
United States, that is we're contributing a little over $600 million towards the global effort to increase access to family planning and reproductive health services. And by the way, that includes program services, contraceptive supplies, technical assistance, a whole array of important components, including special focus on the needs of adolescents, which is clearly an extremely important component of any of these programs. That's where we are, a little over $600 million. Where we should be is closer to $1 billion. Now, we all recognize the difficult economic climate that not just the United States but the whole world is facing right now. But we also know that this is one of our most cost-effective investments, and it has many other benefits, as I alluded to, beyond just allowing women to control their own fertility were not enough. It is fundamental to so many other important goals in global health, in education, in economic development. This level, $600 million, is already reduced from where we started at the beginning of the year, which is closer to about $650 million. And if the leadership in the House of Representatives has their way, this number will be reduced much more, by at least another 25 to 30%. They have targeted this program for disproportionate cuts, just as they've targeted the United States domestic family planning program for actual elimination. The Senate, on the other hand, is coming in saying that the program should be increased, just as the Obama administration has said, and so we have to wait till the end of the year to figure out, to see where we end up. But the fact of the matter is that we are hanging on barely in maintaining the effort that we have as a government. And as I mentioned earlier, we are the single largest donor to this global effort. And we provide a lot of intellectual leadership and policy leadership to the field. And we can't afford to go back, not just in terms of our financial commitment, but also our policy leadership. And as leaders in the House of Representatives are trying to cut the program, they're also trying to hamstring it by attaching policies from the old days, known as the global gag rule, that put restrictions on which NGOs are even qualified to partner with the United States based on ideological restrictions. And they want to cut off support to the UN Population Fund, the most important multilateral partner we have in promoting this cause worldwide.
Great. Thank you, Susan. Any of our listeners, we have almost 20 people listening, please feel free to speak up and ask questions.
Hi, I have a question. My name is Masu Mamaya, and I work for the Association for Women's Rights and Development, AWID. Thank you, first of all, the speakers for their really thoughtful comments. So my question has to do with the relationship. I'm trying to think about the, I'm curious about the relationship between some of the trends we're seeing in terms of population growth, but also the policies that are and are not being used to address them, and the economic crisis. And I'm wondering, I guess this is directed to all the speakers, if you've seen anecdotally or more from research-based evidence about whether there is more or less support for some of these policies, or there could be, given kind of the state of the economy worldwide.
Great, thanks for the question. Any of our speakers would like to jump in and take a first shot at that?
Well, this is Susan. I was going to defer to others, but I can just say, provide a little bit of information. A little bit of information just from our experience, even in the United States, where we see in our current economy, this is the last kind of circumstance in which women want to have unintended pregnancies and unwanted births. And so while there is increasing demand for contraceptive services, they also have less available cash to pay for methods of birth control. And so we're also, what we're seeing around the United States, and I think this is probably replicated throughout the world, is even more challenges, especially financial challenges, to be able to pay for methods of birth control when you're also trying to pay your rent, buy food for your kids, get them clothes for school, and do all of those other things that that are even harder in a time where you have less cash to cover all these costs and the desire to delay or avoid childbirth is even greater than it might be otherwise.
And this is Roger Mark from Population Action International. I could just add to Susan's points to just indicate that internationally there is a series of efforts around integrated population health and environment programming that's supported by USAID and a number of international donors that provide for communities and policymakers at local levels to integrate reproductive health and family planning into natural resource management programs. Many of these programs have a livelihood component and an economic benefit. These programs are being implemented in about 15 countries internationally, and they have demonstrated that when we integrate reproductive health service delivery, access to family planning services and contraception with natural resource management programs, that there are more cost-effective interventions, more women are involved, more young people tend to get involved, that they provide opportunities for women's education, which make them more productive economically and help increase their access to contraception. So there are multiple benefits through these integrated programming opportunities.
Excellent. Thanks, Roger. Thanks, Susan. So as long as we're finished with answering those questions, with that question, I think we have another question. Go ahead. Oh, perhaps not. All right. Well, I have a question, actually, and this could be for really any or all three of our speakers. So I've read that some of our best projections for kind of a leveling out of the global population is somewhere around 9.5 or 10 billion people. I'm wondering what assumptions that those projections make, and what could happen if we do not meet those assumptions, based on, I'm assuming there's some policy assumptions there. What would happen if those assumptions are not met?
This is Roger Margaret, PAI. So that's a, a, of very glad that you asked that question. You know, when we look at the projections, there are generally three scenarios that we look at, sort of high, medium, and low projections. And generally, we are seeing that population is likely to grow from 7 billion today to 9.3 billion by 2050. The high assumption is that the population would be at 10.6 billion. But what is very often missed, and we very often focus on that medium variant, that medium projection of 9.3 billion by 2050, is the only way that we can really get to that number is if we support programs for voluntary access to contraception that allows for declines in fertility. So on average, women are having about 2.5 children per woman today. We need to bring to look at ways to help women bring that down to 2.1 to be able to even meet that medium projection of 9.3 billion by 2050. So there are implications with regard to what we need to do to continue to provide support for voluntary family planning interventions. We also recognize that environmental problems would be much easier to address if the world population peaks at, let's say, 8 billion, rather than continuing to grow to 11 billion or to get higher. So there are broader implications, but the underlying assumption when we look at those projections is that we are enabling women to make decisions about how many children they can have and when they can have those children. And we need to do that through these cost-effective and opportunities in providing access to contraception.
Great. Thanks, Roger. Susan, are you still? Would either of you like to add to that?
Nope. I think Roger Mark said it.
Okay. Great. Okay. Star 7 will unmute your line if you have a question for any of our esteemed speakers today. Okay. Jody, would you like to come back and maybe wrap this up or ask another question? I don't see anybody else expressing interest to ask a question.
Hi, folks. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I wasn't sure if I'd unmuted or muted. Well, I think if there are no more questions, then I want to just thank everyone for participating in the call and for, especially to the speakers, for taking time to do this call with us. As I said earlier, an audio file will be available and be disseminated widely, as will the links to the pieces written by these and other authors on our site regarding the issue of the opportunities and challenges with regard to the global mark of 7 billion people. I really appreciate your participation, and thank you all for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.